The act of eating is relatively easy. Am I hungry? Is that food? And down the gullet it goes. The more complicated act is thinking in advance about what to eat. Some of us put lots of thought into this, and some of us a bit less thought. Our guest this hour gives us a guide to putting some thought into the food we eat, so this is more about the shopping than the eating. Sophie Egan's book is called How to Be a Conscious Eater, subtitled Making Food Choices That Are Good for You, Others, and the Planet. Sophie Egan works for the Culinary Institute of America and uses her Master of Public Health degree as the Director of Health and Sustainability Leadership for the Strategic Initiatives Group at CIA. She writes a lot about food, where it intersects with health and the planet. This is her second book. Hi, Sophie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. You have a weekend hobby, you admit. You usually spend hours where?
Yes, I spend hours in the grocery store. I used to have my now husband, then boyfriend, actually drop me off at my favorite grocery store for about an hour, and I would just, I didn't have anything to buy, actually. I just like to browse through the items and look at where they're from, the stories behind the products, and really the great variety. We're so lucky in the U.S. to have such an abundance and diversity of food. So grocery shopping is an essential act. Eating is an essential act. But admittedly, for me, it is also a great source of pleasure and inspiration and endless fascination. There's so much to learn.
There really is, but it sounds like a bit of a food detective there. So when new things show up, you're aware of it, and you begin asking questions about where they came from, huh?
Absolutely.
So
yes, and you know, there's been a growing movement to know your food, right? Know where your food comes from and transparency, and hopefully we'll get into some of that and knowing what's in it. But there's a lot of confusion too, and the book How to Be a Conscious Eater aims to both enable consumers to be those detectives, to know what to look for and what to look out for.
So this is only partly about the health of the eater. I mean, you think a bit bigger than that, and the subtitle of the book hints to this: good choices that are good for you, others, and the planet.
Right. So the goal is really twofold: to help broaden our lenses, to zoom out and evaluate food through a more holistic set of viewpoints than just, is it good for me? Does it match my own personal needs? Now, that is, of course, very important, especially with coronavirus. I call it corona conscious eating, and we can get into things like immune systems and all of that. But also asking yourself, is it good for others? Is it good for the planet? For me, good for others really comes down to all the animals and people affected from farm to fork or from farm to grocery basket, the entire food system that's behind the food that we're fortunate enough to have on our plates or to have in our pantries. And it's through those three lenses that you can really know that you're aligning your food choices with your values. And I also really want to emphasize that it's an evolution over time. It's conscious eating to me is not a diet. It's not a set of hard and fast rules. But this is a three-part mental checklist that helps you sort of have a compass, a North Star, when deciding how to allocate your grocery dollars. And it's also, though, provided through a very short and sweet essays, bottom line answers to those most top of mind questions, very visual, and enough information to help you feel informed so you can make food choices you feel good about. But we're also very overwhelmed with so much information. So it's not information overload. We have enough of that as it is.
So let's talk about the changes in lifestyle from coronavirus lockdown. Does that prompt any additional questions beyond good for you, good for others, good for the planet?
I think it really does. A couple of examples that I can share with you. So when we think about good for me, to me, being whether something is good for you or good for me is about nutrition, yes, but it's also the whole person. Right now, that might mean thinking about comfort food. So many of us might be stress eating or just thinking that comfort food means just junk food. But is it also leaving us feeling good afterwards? How are we thinking about foods in our immune systems? How are we thinking about foods that and beverages and how that might relate to our ability to get a good night's sleep? Thinking like about caffeine, for example, or keeping alcohol intake in check. Added sugar can affect that as well. There's a lot of other things as well that relate to the immune system. We can get into those. But in terms of others, This is, I think, shifting a bit about who we're including in that category right now. I would urge folks to think about food insecurity and the incredibly disturbing reality that 40 million Americans are hungry, and we at the same time waste 40% of the food in this country. And if we just redistributed about a third of that, we could feed all the hungry people. During the time of coronavirus, with schools closed, this is especially a crisis for many vulnerable populations, kids who rely on those meals in school, sometimes for the only food that they get in the day, and definitely sometimes the most nutritious. So we need to be really mindful of our neighbors, our community members who may be having a particularly difficult time accessing food, and think about what we can do. And the last thing that is especially relevant in coronavirus, other than the topics we mentioned, along with, of course, stocking a healthy pantry, are thinking about restaurants. I am, you know, part of this industry. I've been part of the restaurant food service industry, leading health and sustainability initiatives for the past 5.5 years. And there's talk of a species on the brink of extinction when it comes to independent restaurants. This is not hyperbole. This is really how chefs and restaurant workers, restaurateurs are talking about it. And we have a role to play as eaters, conscious eaters, to allocate our takeout choices and our delivery orders to help restaurants, and particularly those smaller local restaurants, and the farmers, local and small-scale farmers throughout our regions, whose distribution channels are largely cut off right now through some direct-to-consumer pathways that we can get into.
Okay, so here again, you know, to support the people who provide food for you locally is part of this, about the good for others, with some additional choices, as we're talking about during coronavirus lockdown. Sophie Egan's book is How to Be a Conscious Eater, Making Food Choices That Are Good for You, Others, and the Planet. We'll come back to the discussion on the Jefferson Exchange. You're welcome to join us. We return in a minute 20. You do point out you're a little more weighted toward environment and human health instead of animal and social welfare. Lay that out for us a bit, Sophie.
Sure. And thanks again, too, for the warm welcome and the warm intro. Some news to share, too, which is that I'm actually now the owner and founder of a new consulting practice called Full Table Solutions that continues the work I have done. And the Culinary Institute of America is a client of mine. So I get to have the honor of continuing to serve as a co-director of the Menus of Change University Research Collaborative in partnership with Stanford as part of that role. Definitely continuing the work around the intersection of food, health, and climate. But very excited to share that update.
Congratulations.
And in terms of the lenses, yeah, thank you. So the urgency of climate action is a big part of the greater emphasis. So I have that three-part checklist, as we talked about: good for you, good for others, good for the planet. But we have, often it's called the triple threat of obesity, malnutrition or undernutrition, hunger, and climate change. And those three, at the intersection of human and environmental health, just are require that we act so swiftly, so rapidly. There really are emergencies. They're slower moving emergencies and crises than coronavirus, certainly, but their severity is equally important. And so that is where there's a bit more emphasis in the book on those two lenses. The good news is that more often than not, what's good for us is good for the planet. And a big example of that is eating a mostly plant-based diet, as people like to say. I don't like the notion of diets. I think it's best to think about what you can eat in the long run. And by that, I mean an emphasis on plant-based foods. So it's often called flexitarian or plant-forward or plant-centric or plant-rich. It just means that the bulk or the majority, the proportion that makes up the food you eat. So whole grains, nuts, legumes, lots of fruits and vegetables. If you have that as your general approach for the foods you eat most of the time, the routine foods, that's going to get you a really long way in terms of optimizing your own well-being, maintaining a healthy weight, which is by far the most important thing you can do from a cancer risk reduction standpoint. And it's going to be leaving the least imprint on our natural resources in terms of water and land use, as well as greenhouse gas emissions. But of course, the other aspect of animal welfare and the bucket that I refer to as others, so farm workers, restaurant workers, these are also critically important. It's not to minimize them by any stretch, and that's why I think they really belong in that equal territory of the three-part kind of mental checklist. But looking at the intersection of human and environmental health, more often than not, we will also be doing what's good for the people and animals. An example is organic or regenerative practices. This is a farming, regenerative is essentially organic plus. It's a way of farming that really is supports soil health. Organic in particular, or both do not use synthetic pesticides. They rely on cover crops and crop rotation, and regenerative practices can actually sequester carbon in the soil. Doing that is clearly better for the planet, but guess what? It's also better for farm workers because they're not exposed to those harmful chemicals. And then it's better for us because those chemicals are not going in our bodies. So there's a lot of ways that you can have win-win-win across the board.
All right. So this gets us into the part of the book called Stuff That Comes From the Ground, as opposed to the later part, Stuff That Comes From Animals, Stuff That Comes From Factories, and Stuff That Comes From Restaurants. And in Stuff That Comes From the Ground, you start with almonds. And I'm glad because there's a lot of concern about the water use with almonds. Would you put that in context for us, Sophie?
Definitely. I think context is the perfect word. That was the goal with that chapter. Because almonds, from a health standpoint, and nuts more generally, are an incredibly healthy thing to eat. I mean, there is just clear scientific consensus. And I should say that as a guiding rule in the book, I draw on consensus. I'm not interested in one-off studies that, you know, challenge everything you thought you knew about X and now you should believe Y. That's just alarmist often and not where we should be putting most of our stock in terms of our choices. So I really draw from things like the Eat Lancet report, a global commission of scientists aligning optimal nutrition and environmental science. I draw on things like Old Ways, Common Ground. This is where nutrition scientists, what do they agree on? And that's where you get the most evergreen guidance that we can really rely on for a lifetime. So when it comes to something like almonds, there is broad scientific consensus that eating nuts is a really important part of a healthy diet from a chronic disease prevention standpoint, maintaining a healthy weight, and generally living a long and healthy life. They're part of the Mediterranean diet, most famously. So when you then hear about the water footprint, so, you know, several years back, and all of a sudden people thought, hey, I thought I was being a conscious eater, and now I'm getting water shamed by my friends. You know, I spent the better part of my adult years in California, and all of a sudden it was like, how irresponsible of you. Huh. But what was missing was that context, which is that, yes, it takes a lot of water to produce almonds, but far less than a lot of other foods, such as beef. Think about the gallons involved in a hamburger, 660 gallons, a chocolate bar, 450 gallons. Dairy and milk, are pretty high as well. So when you put when you situate almonds in the context of other foods, and generally, as I mentioned, foods that come from the ground are going to have a lower footprint than foods that come from animals, mostly because you have to grow all the food to feed the animals. This is why you have higher footprint in terms of land use and greenhouse gases as well. So it's just important to keep that in mind as we're thinking, as we're thinking good, bad. There's usually more nuance. And especially with something like almonds, we have to keep the common refrain of as opposed to what. So if you're eating almonds as a snack instead of cheese, that may have a lower water footprint, actually, as a snack. If you're eating almonds instead of an apple, that has a higher footprint, but not by a lot. So it's just important that we keep in mind as opposed to what And then we keep the bigger context in mind.
Okay, and here again, we're talking about the planet care in addition to our own selves. But so this brings us back to food waste. And you mentioned earlier that Americans waste about 40% of their food. I think that was at 30% worldwide.
That's right. Yes.
Yeah. So you
and,
got,
and worldwide, mm-hmm. if you know a helpful statistic as well is that if food waste were a country, it would be the third largest emitter after China and the U.S.
Wow. That says a lot right there. So you provide got a top five list of the things we shouldn't waste, and it looks like red meat gets to the top of that list. Why?
That's right. So in general, one of the things I really want to emphasize is that our food choices are an often overlooked but incredibly powerful tool for climate action. So yes, there's taking care of ourselves and others, as we said, but really can make in the aggregate, small steps add up. So there's this great list provided by Drawdown of the 80 most effective solutions for reversing global warming. Number four is eating a plant-rich diet, and number three is wasting less food. So that really tells you the scale, the magnitude of your daily choices and how they collectively really make a difference. You know, this is in the comparison of things like solar panels and electric vehicles and flying less. So when it comes to what ways not to waste, red meat is the most important not to waste because of how environmentally intensive it is to produce. So in general with red meat, and red meat, I should say, is meat that comes from mammals, ruminants in particular. These are ones that have a rumen, that's a type of stomach, or cows, especially in the U.S., are the biggest source. Beef, we eat a lot of beef in the U.S., on average, 3 hamburgers worth per person per week. We need to be really mindful of all the resources that are going down the drain when we waste that red meat. So the water involved, all the land that was used to grow all the corn, typically, or the pasture, the grass that maybe if it was a pasture-raised type of cow. So red meat is the most important not to eat, and that's where you can have a huge impact, is just using and being really intentional with the red meat that you are purchasing. So I suggest, as a general rule for avoiding waste, is use a shopping list. This sounds really, really obvious. Surprisingly few people use one. That can help you avoid impulse buys and make sure that you really have a plan for a meal that you're going to be using that all the ingredients that you buy throughout the week, and especially when you're purchasing red meat. So I suggest a first less than better approach to the red meat. Then there are several other ways for wasting less food. A great one is loving your leftovers. Some people, I think, have gotten really fun and creative with stir fry Fridays or waste less Wednesdays. And this is a way to just be very intentional. Other people, you can designate a section of your refrigerator as like, eat this first, a certain, section of it. Because often we just forget about leftovers. And that relates to the broader tip as well, which is just to make food visible. So often something can just get buried in the back. So you can maybe make a routine of once a week, say, kind of reorganizing your fridge so that the stuff that needs to be eaten the soonest is toward the front. And then the last thing I'll say is love your freezer, especially now with coronavirus and being really concerned about food lasting a while when we're making our grocery trips. You can freeze almost anything. Bread, for example, especially if you slice it first. Cheese, if you shred it first. Even milk and eggs, you can kind of scramble them beforehand out of their shells and throw them in the freezer. So really looking at ways to make the food that we have last as long as possible. And then if you do have composting as an option, that can also go a long way to avoid the amount of food that's just winding up in landfills, emitting all kinds of harmful greenhouse gases.
Yeah, this is the part of the book that made me regret those moments when I pull something out of the Tupperware and go, oh, I forgot that was there. I wanted to eat that before it got all fuzzy yeah. and white. So here we are. Sophie Egan's
played plans.
Yeah. Sophie Egan is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She works on the intersection of food, health, and climate. She's the founder of the consulting company Full Table Solutions. She's the author of How to Be a Conscious Eater, Making Food Choices That Are Good for You, Others, and the Planet. You are welcome to join this conversation. 800-838-3760 is the phone number. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. We welcome Bill in Sutherland back to the Exchange. Hi, Bill.
Yeah, how are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. How are you holding up?
Good. I have a comment to make. Packaging.
Uh-huh.
I try to buy as much as I can in the bulk section of the store, and they even have cookies. Now, when you go to the cookie aisle, look at all the pack. Just imagine. Everybody just imagine where all this stuff goes when we get done with it. All this packaging. I try to recycle as much as I can, like the cardboard boxes off of cereal boxes. Mm-hmm. You can recycle those. Not in Douglas County, though.
All right.
But if you take it to Tulane County, which I do when I go up there. But anyway, all this packaging all ends up in the landfill. Can you even imagine how much stuff we're throwing in the landfill? It's ridiculous.
It is. When you talk about cookies in particular, I think about the little hard plastic trays that come in the soft plastic wrapper often inside the cardboard box.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I don't buy them. I won't buy them.
All right. Bill, thanks for the thoughts, and let's take it there with Sophie.
Oh, Bill, hats off to you. I couldn't agree with you more, and I think that your comment on the cookie aisle is a great one because it really it just shows the lens through which you're viewing your world, your food world. And that's the goal, really, with How to Be a Conscious Eater, is to have that filter, essentially, or aperture on when you're going about your decisions, as opposed to just, you know, hey, how many added grams of added sugar, which, yes, is important in the cookie aisle, but so is the packaging, as you said. Packaging is a huge problem because, as you said, so little of it can be recycled. There's an interesting sustainable packaging coalition that's emerged. It's early days, but they've actually been collectively kind of crowdsourcing a compostable packaging. So there is Alter Eco is a chocolate brand, for example, that is the first ever to use it. It's only industrial compost friendly, so if you have curbside pickup, that would work, as opposed to backyard compost. But by and large, the packaging is either go straight to landfill, as you said, or in the U.S., we only recycle about 9% of plastic. There's a lot of confusion because of all the little numbers and which type of plastic can you recycle, and it really varies by municipality, and it's a zoo. So I have a section in the book called 10 Ways to Part with Plastic, and I definitely include in there the tip from Bill, which is to, as much as possible, shop the bulk area, because not only is it, and some grocery stores now are rebranding those as plastic-free, the plastic-free aisle, which I think is great, because you can bring your own container. More and more grocers also will let you, they'll subtract the weight of the container, the glass jar, or the mesh bag that you bring, or cotton bag that you bring for yourself. And then the other great thing about the bulk section is that it is a great way to economize. Often what you're actually paying for is all that packaging. You're paying for the branding and all of the marketing that went into it, and the raw materials. And with bulk, that's often why the price, not only that you're buying a larger quantity possibly, but that you are only paying for the food itself.
Let's take another call here. Let's go to Hope in Honeydew, California. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Sophie Egan.
Well, hi. I don't all nuts use basically the same amount of water, and it was the people that have the water first in the valley that I think gave almonds a bad name. And ounce for ounce of water, and if you count calories, I would imagine lettuce uses much more water than almonds and rice.
Okay, good points. Thanks for those, Hope. Appreciate it, Sophie.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, great question. So there actually are differences by type of nut. So peanuts, for example, which are actually a legume, use very, very little water. They're the lowest water users of all the nuts. Then in terms of calorie, like you said, it's true. It's not. I have a diagram that shows by serving, because I really think that's more useful. None of us can live off of lettuce alone, right? So sometimes some of these foods, or like potatoes, will get sort of seen as oh, really low greenhouse gas emissions. Guess what else has really low greenhouse gas emissions? Sugar has a very but we have to think holistically, which is again the goal is, okay, how does this, what is the kind of the trade-offs or what's the bang for my buck. And with almonds, for example, the beauty is that you're getting a really healthy and filling food at the same time that it's a relatively low water footprint. And on the point of water rights, that's actually very true in almonds, is that for a long time, flood irrigation was the typical approach. And a lot of the expose has changed the way that almond production, kind of the default to more precise techniques like drip irrigation and other efforts that have really brought down the water footprint, thanks to some improvements there for sure in California, for example.
A lot more to talk about how we stock the fridge and the cabinets. Sophie Egan's our guest. Her book is How to Be a Conscious Eater. And we're back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. We were talking a few moments ago about food packaging, and that led you to talk about Alter Eco, the chocolates, which I went to their website, noticed that they talk about not only organic but regenerative farming practices. Are there easy labels to pick up on that indicate that the food is regenerative? Is it going to take some reading when we look at the stuff in the store?
Yes, I'm so glad you brought up regenerative, which is a really exciting emerging label. It's not yet widely available. It's in the pilot form, essentially. And it's basically agricultural production practices that are like organic plus. So no synthetic pesticides. They are all about sequestering carbon in the soil. And soil health in general is incredibly important. There's a host of practices involved with regenerative, and a large number of food manufacturers, Annie's and General Mills, Patagonia Provisions, quite a few others are getting really excited about converting their land to regenerative. But right now, it is tough if you're an eater to know which ones, which products might be from regeneratively grown ingredients. So look out for the label. I think it's going to really expand soon. But for now, like you said, kind of doing your homework ahead of time is the best way to support that really exciting and really environmentally powerful and socially powerful form of production.
And if you missed the first part of the interview, I want to remind people, Sophie does have a hobby of walking through grocery stores on weekends without buying things, just to look at what's out there and to look at labels. So she's gotten up on this stuff. So there's a great key in here to reading labels that make claims about whole grains. Which do you recommend latching onto and which to walk past?
Yes, whole grains. So in general, most people don't eat nearly enough whole grains, which is a bummer because whole grains can be cancer researchers are one of the most protective foods, in part because of the fiber, and they've been tied to a host of other health benefits from heart disease and type 2 diabetes, obesity, et cetera. They're also, in general, actually a source of protein, which most people don't know, and they are a very low environmental footprint overall. So when you're looking for whole grains, what to look for, I have this guide, as you said, in the book. Also did a piece for the New York Times last week on ways to look for whole grain labels. And basically it comes down to a couple things. So the simplest thing is to look for the whole grains stamp. This is a yellow little sticker. It looks like a postal stamp that the Old Ways Council has put together, and it's 100%, 50%. And that's a way to know, okay, this all the grain in this product is whole. And just to back up, whole versus not whole, refined, in grains that are not whole, it means that the most nutritious parts, this is crazy if you ask me, the most nutritious parts, the germ and the bran, have actually been removed from the grain kernel. So it's what's left is the endosperm, and that's the starchy stuff. So that in itself, by the way, is a form of food waste. And there's a growing recognition of this, led in part by the really phenomenal Dr. Stephen Jones at the Bread Lab at Washington State University to raise awareness of this waste issue that's going on. But back to the labels, there's the 100% whole grain label, 50%+ whole grain, and then whole grain. So that's telling you what percentage of the grain in that product is whole. That's the easiest. But what if that little sticker is not on the product? Then I look straight for the ingredients list. And ideally, the first ingredient is a whole grain. In the book, I describe examples of but is a whole grain. Oats are a common one. Whole wheat flour, you'd want to see that it says whole, not just flour, but whole wheat flour. Sorghum, amaranth, there's an incredible diversity of whole grains. So definitely can check out the Whole Grains Council's website as well for a full list. But ideally, that first ingredient is a whole grain.
The diversity part, I want to come back, I want to settle on the diversity part here for a moment, because this is something that comes up quite a bit in the book, because I get the sense that people do tend to buy the same things over and over again. And when you're trying to get them to eat in ways that are healthy for them, other people, and the planet, they could get a little bored with, you know, eating same fruits and vegetables all the time and stuff. But as you point out, we tend to get ourselves into fairly narrow zones. So if you just expand the list of things you buy, you find things like what you're talking about here with these great heritage grains that are different from the wheat products you're used to eating.
That's right. Oh, my gosh. Eating consciously, I think you will find, many people will find, is actually a way to expand the variety of foods that you get to enjoy. Because it's in so many cases, we've just been overlooking. Think of just the legume category alone. I mean, chickpeas, lentils, there are, I don't even know the exact number, dozens and dozens of kinds of beans. I think right now with coronavirus, there's a great cookbook called Cool Beans by Joe Yonan that's completely sold out because people are like, oh my God, I had no idea there were so many great ways to cook with beans. Beans are like the triple, you know, example of good for us, good for the planet, good for our budget, and good for others. And it's in that a realization of, and grains, you know, landrace, heirloom, ancient grains, millet, fonio, an enormous diversity. Bob's Red Mill is a provider that has gained some notoriety for helping us expand our understanding of the diversity, but it really is not limiting. I think there's a misconception, especially when you emphasize plant-based foods. A lot of the vegan and vegetarian conversation is often about what is being removed, what you no longer get to eat. That is not my message whatsoever. It's actually about the incredible discovery and adventure that's awaiting us, especially when you think about the fact that 75% of the foods that we eat, or the calories that we get, come from just 12 crops and 5 types of animals. I mean, how boring is that? If you even think going to produce, I think in terms of the boredom piece, if you start to eat more seasonally, you can really, seasonally and regionally is also a great way to increase the diversity of all the types of foods that you eat, because there might be things that are not in your grocery stores to start with, but they are available. I grew up in Washington State, going to Lake Chelan, where many of the great apples come from. And I know in Oregon too, I mean, you can be shocked how many kinds of apples there are that won't wind up on the big box store. So when you start to look through the lenses of discovery and adventure in grains and beyond, I think you really begin to see how much there is to experiment with, spelt to test, and they're all have different flavor profiles. I think the other thing to mention is that often we think about grains, wheat especially, like flour, as just a vehicle for other flavors, right? Like you put toast, you put jam on toast, or put sauce on pasta. But actually, a lot of different types of wheat, not only different types of grain, but there's quite a variety of wheats out there that actually have flavor in themselves. You can be absolutely shocked at how delicious and nutty and deep in flavor some of these can be.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about the generations of people who just assumed that bread was something you wrapped around a chunk of meat for a sandwich.
Yeah, that's true. No, it's very true. And I think there's another great example of community grains in California that does identity preserved traceability, fully traceable, which is incredible from a supply chain transparency standpoint as consumers, you know, our eaters, our right to know. But also is all about this growing local grain economy movement. All across the country, there are these coalitions of millers, breeders, bakers, chefs, who are really trying to breed for flavor. In Oregon, there's some work going on there, and in New York as well. and to elevate the status of grains and bread, as you said. Good, really good bread, and the bread lab that I mentioned is all about not only the deliciousness of different types of grains, but actually 100% whole grain, which is really, it just will completely change the way you view these items. And I think one of the silver linings I'm hoping I'm seeing emerge throughout the corona virus, and as I say, corona conscious eating, is that some of those foods, those pantry staples of flours, that is, you know, grain flours, cornmeal perhaps, beans, legumes, their status is, I think, being elevated a bit in our food culture. And that could have really positive long-term effects.
So let's stick on the subject of corona conscious eating, because as I think you pointed out in notes to the producers that you know, some people are basically cooking all of a sudden. You know, they're preparing food for themselves at home where they didn't used to do much of that.
That's right. And, you know, in my first book, Devoured, just all about why we eat what and how we eat in the United States, I lament about the loss of food literacy in the U.S. And how little time many of us have in our busy lives to make food a priority. And just culturally, you know, kids get very little time in school even to eat, much less to learn about food. So there's, of course, great work going on through things like Edible Schoolyard and Food Corps to integrate culinary literacy and food literacy into K-12 curriculum, and amazing work going on in K-12 schools that I was very proud to be part of as well, to improve the food there. But, you know, really, it's this chance to now with coronavirus to to get better acquainted with our kitchens, with raw ingredients, with preparing food. It's very satisfying to prepare food for yourself, but it can also be extremely intimidating. And I don't take that too lightly. I think there's a lot of, we're out of practice in many cases. So what can you do? Thankfully, YouTube is a great resource. You can learn just about anything. I really urge folks to start with. If your kitchen is not stocked, the number one thing you need is at least one good knife, sharp knife. It needs to be sharp. Because if you, in terms of skills, the number one thing is to watch, you know, a YouTube video or find an online way to learn a little bit of knife skills, because if it's frustrating to chop food, your whole experience of cooking is going to be frustrating.
Yes, yes, I've noticed that. With a dull knife, yeah, you can really turn yourself off of cooking if you're working with bad tools.
Right, right. Yeah, so got to start there. That sounds like boring, maybe not the fun stuff and the sizzle and smell of all the rest of it, but that's got to be where it starts. The other thing is to think about, you know, what are some kind of easy ways you can ease in? Get a positive feedback loop going with yourself, some early wins, because it's all a lot about confidence. And I think sometimes part of the intimidation comes from thinking that it has to be perfectly Instagrammable and it has to be so, you know, plated in a way that looks like a restaurant. Cooking does not need to be elaborate. I mean, I tend to have a rule of like 5 ingredients or less on weeknights. Because it's just, it takes the pressure off, you know? And you can make a lot of really delicious foods with very few ingredients if you have herbs and spices, and just encourage you to experiment. There's a lot of good resources that have popped up to try to help folks learn how to cook. Samin Nosrat is a famous chef who has the book Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat. She's got a forthcoming podcast all about home cooking. There is a quarantine cooking show on Washington Post YouTube channel. Bon Appetit has a fantastic cooking channel on YouTube. So those are great. But then also just recognizing too that a lot of us are eating, cooking for the first time, but we're doing so under a budget. And this is going to probably be a new reality for us economically going forward. Another great resource is called Good and Cheap. This is a cookbook by Leanne Brown. It's with my same publisher, Workman, really inspiring about ideas for cooking on $4 a day or less. And she actually offers this available for free as a downloadable PDF, and over 1 million people have downloaded it. Of course, you can support your local booksellers as well and purchase the book itself. But that's a great place to look for especially those budget-friendly ideas.
Have your we're just a couple seconds left here. Have your excursions to grocery stores subsided for the moment?
Yeah, I've had to take up some new hobbies. That's a good point. You know, it's interesting. I still am the primary decision maker, as I think many I have little 1-year-old boys, and many parents find themselves, you know, we still need to feed our families well, but I am shopping online more, and it's a different experience. It's not I find it helpful that many retailers do provide ways to still check labels through the photos and so forth. I often will check that out ahead of time, but it's certainly not the joy and pleasure. It's a little bit more of a tense duty, as it is an essential act, as we said, no longer the hobby of yore.
All right. It'll come back at some point, though. We're confident. Sophie Egan's book is called How to Be a Conscious Eater, Making Food Choices That Are Good for You, Others, and the Planet. Sophie, thank you so much. That'll do it for today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley with Randy Babbitt. Have a great day.